Cool. Yeah. So for those of you, all right, yeah, I'll go ahead and get started. So for those of you who haven't met me, my name's Adam Boland, PhD student at MIT, and today I'm going to tell you about why physicists should care about computational complexity theory. So already in this conference, you've heard a few different applications of complexity theory to theoretical physics. So, like for instance, you've heard some speakers talk about things like circuit complexity, and there you're usually asking questions like, what is the shortest circuit to perform some particular operation? Or say to perform some, either perform a particular unitary or prepare a particular state. And this has come up recently in, the complexity equals action conjecture. It's come up in some of these connections maybe to geometry and wormhole physics. This notion of complexity might seem somewhat like more physical to you than what complexity theorists talk about. Because normally complexity theorists talk about complexity classes. And what's a complexity class? A complexity class is actually a subset of strings. So here, 0, 1, star, this is just like taking the clean star. It's like an irregular expression. It means you have, any finite number of elements from this set. So, we say that, some subset of strings is in a language if Turing machines with some particular properties recognize them in some efficient amount of time. And, this seems kind of like a more mathematical expression of what complexity is about, which seems a little less attached to the physical world. I think it's a very natural question for physicists to ask, what do these complexity classes have to, have to do with physics? I mean, so some complexity classes, it's kind of clear that they maybe have some sort of physical interpretation, like, P is something like the set of problems which are solvable in polynomial time. All right, so that makes sense because that seems like that class is related to, what sorts of problems you can actually solve in the real world. Or BQP is the same thing with quantum versions. And there are other classes like, NP, which are, the set of problems for which you can prove the answer in polynomial time. Sorry, so for which you can. I'll say for which you can find the polynomial length proof. So you can't necessarily find the proof in polynomial time, but you can find the short proof. That it might take you a really long time to find the proof, but once you have the proof, you know you have it. This is kind of like mathematics. It's very difficult to find the proofs of theorems, but once you have a proof, then you know it's correct, right?
Sorry, this is just verifying the solution, right?
Yeah, this is just verifying the solution.
Actual equation. Once you know it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the question was, is this just verifying solution? Yeah, this is just saying it's easy to verify the solution. Now, on the other hand, there are other complexity classes that people define which start to get a bit more abstract. Like, for instance, there's this class sigma 2. These are problems for which you can prove that no proof will convince you of the fact, right? And now that seems like a kind of abstract complexity class. I mean, it's starting to get very meta, right? And then, there are other classes that people find like, C equals P. This is something like languages solvable. So you say something's in the language if the probability of acceptance of a randomized algorithm for this problem is exactly equal to a half. All right, so these classes are kind of starting to lose touch with reality, right? I mean, like, this class is what you can do physically. This class is what you can prove. This is what you can prove that you can't prove. And this is some kind of weird model of computations. These classes kind of very quickly end up increasing in abstraction. And there's actually a huge number of complexity classes that people have defined. So there's this thing called the complexity zoo, which is a running catalog of all the complexity classes that have appeared in the literature, and there are currently 535 classes in this, ranging from, you know, ones that everyone's heard of, like P and NP, to like extremely bizarre classes. So, yeah, and you know, there's, by the way, as a reference, if you're ever interested in kind of delving into this, there's also something called the petting zoo. And that has only 17 classes in it. So if you're looking to get started, you know, those are like the 17 most popular ones that have appeared. So, all right. So anyway, so in short, you know, these classes seem to get fairly abstract. So a physicist might ask, what's the point of these? You know, it seems like they're just abstract mathematical theorizing. All right, well, today I'm going to try to convince you that these classes are actually super relevant for physics. I'm going to give you three reasons why that's the case. All right, so the first reason is that it can sometimes help you come up with better quantum simulations. All right, so let's say that you're trying to simulate how a quantum computer functions, right? So let's say that you have some circuit, and you start in the state 0 to the n, then you apply a bunch of 2-qubit gates, and then you measure the first qubit on the computational basis, and this tells you your answer. So now, how would you simulate this process on a computer, like if you were writing it up in MATLAB? So just give me the completely naive thing to do.
Big matrices.
Big matrices, exactly. So the way that, you know, the naive way to do it would be something like this. So you know that the state of the quantum computer at any point in time, it's like a complex vector with 2 to the n numbers, right? So, and you know, your unitary matrices, these are like 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices, right? So one way that you could simulate a quantum computer is you could store all these numbers and just multiply these gigantic matrices by them. Okay? So the thing is that it's what's kind of a fascinating result in quantum complexity theory, which maybe isn't obvious, is that you can actually do better than this. All right? And in particular, you can actually do this simulation in something which still takes an exponential amount of time, but which only takes a polynomial amount of space. So I'm going to formalize what I mean by that. So, like, so there's this, in complexity, we call this a p-space algorithm. So a p-space algorithm is an algorithm which runs in a polynomial amount of space. In other words, like, it only uses a polynomial amount of memory on your computer, but possibly an exponential amount of time. All right, and you know, this algorithm here is not a p-space algorithm because you have to store these 2 to the n numbers at every time, and that's an exponentially long vector you're storing in memory. All right, but the cool thing is that there's this cool fact, which is that BQP is actually contained in p-space. So it means if you want to know the answer to your problem or you want to factor integers, it actually suffices to do a polynomial space computation. All right, so now why is this true? I'll briefly go through the proof of this fact. So the proof of this fact is actually basically comes from the Feynman path integral. All right, so what do I mean by that? Well, let's consider the state of our computer at the end of the computation. Let's call this psi final. All right, so let's say that psi final, you know, this is equal to some superposition of computational basis states with some amplitudes beta sub x. So this is over x and 0, 1 to the n. And we know that this state you can obtain by taking this initial all zeros vector and multiplying it by all of the matrices in your circuit, right? So this is equal to ut times ut minus 1 times u2 times u1 times the state 0 to the nth power. All right, so far I haven't really said anything. But I'm just going to write out, I'm just going to expand this equation for psi final. So, in general, when you multiply matrices, if you want to consider the value of AB, IJ, this is equal to something like this, sum over k of aik bkj, right? You just sum over the repeated indices in between. This is just matrix multiplication. So if we write this out, what we'll see is something like this, that you can write an expression for each individual beta x, which looks like this. Well, okay, it's the sum over some intermediate values of your final values, x value with its I1 value, ut minus 1, and then it's I minus, yeah, then it's I1, I2 value, you know, et cetera, down to u1's I sub t, and then it's 0 to the n value, right? All right, does everyone agree with this formula? So the reason that I set this value to 0 to the n is because we actually don't care about all the entries in this giant matrix multiplication. We only care about the first column of it, right? Because, you know, we're only multiplying it to the all zeros vector, right? Okay, cool. So now I'm going to assert that this summation can actually has a physical interpretation. And all right, so here these I1s are all in 0, 1 to the n, right? Okay, so the physical interpretation that this has is this is actually, you can think of this as a sum over all possible histories the string could have taken of the amplitude that it took to get to that final state. All right, so what do I mean by that? So, all right, so I'm going to write this out. So I'm going to say, I'm going to claim this is the sum over paths p ending in x of some quantity alpha p, where alpha p is the alpha p is kind of the product of the matrix entries along the path. All right, so now all I've done, actually all I'm doing here is taking this formula and giving it a physical interpretation. So I'm saying that if your state starts in 0 to the n, you know, a possible history of the state is, well, first you flip the first 0. That's like if it is, you know, all zeros and then the 1. And then maybe you flip the second 0, and then you took it to some other state, and then to some other state, okay, and then finally it ended up at x, right? And alpha p is just, you know, the matrix entries that you encountered along that path, right? Because it's just this product, right? So, and you can think of this, this is really not complicated. It's like, that you can do this with any quantum circuit. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, imagine this circuit. Imagine you apply two Hadamards in a row and then measure. What's the state of the circuit at the end? Well, initially your state is the state 0. But now, as you go through the Hadamard, you have two choices. You can either move to a 1 or stay at a 0, right? And the first occurs with amplitude 1 over root 2. That's the 0, 0 entry of the Hadamard gate. And the second occurs with entry 1 over root 2 as well, right? All right, now you apply the Hadamard again. And now the probability, all right, so now the amplitude, so now 0 goes to 0 and 1 with those same amplitudes. And now 1 goes to 0 and 1 with the same things, but you get 1 minus sign, right? Like the 1, 1 term is negative 1 in the Hadamard matrix, right? So now, if you want to compute what's the amplitude on the state 1 at the end of the computation, all you do is you look at all paths in this tree, and you compute what's the amplitude along that path. So, all right, so these are the two paths down the tree that end in the state 1. So one of them has amplitude plus a half, one has amplitude minus a half, so it's 0. So this tells you that this circuit returns to 0. So this is, yeah, this is all that it's that saying. Now, the nice thing about this sum is the following. So note that for each path, you can compute the value of alpha p efficiently. So if someone tells you a particular history, like, oh, first I went to 0, then I went to 1, then I stayed at 1, then I went back to 0, you know, and that you read out various entries of the matrix, you know, I can tell you the value of alpha p efficiently because, you know, each of these gates is local. It's just like a little 2x2 or 4x4 matrix, right? So you just look up one entry of the matrix corresponds to that transition. And furthermore, the amount of branching that you undergo at each gate is at most a factor of 4, right? Because if it's a 2-qubit gate, if you have any given input string, there are most four possible output strings it can map to under that local two-qubit gate. So that means that the number of paths is always less than or equal to 4 to the n. So what this is saying is that this quantity is an exponential sum of polynomial time computable values. And I claim that this is enough to compute this sum in P space for any particular x you care about. So this tells you that beta x has this form. And in particular, you can, So now this thing you can actually compute with a polynomial amount of space, right? All you do is you write a for loop and you say for each path, you know, you store what the path looks like. That only takes a polynomial amount of space. You loop over all paths, and then you keep a counter of what your amplitude you've added up to so far is, right? And this is a p-space algorithm. So in some sense, you know, this is kind of like a Feynman path integral because you're summing over histories. Now, it's not quite one because, you know, you're not performing a continuous integral, but it's maybe morally informed by the Feynman path integral. All right, cool. All right, so yeah. Now there's also, so now note that I've only showed how you can compute this for a single amplitude. You know, there's also a way, so you know, a single amplitude doesn't tell you the probability of seeing one in this circuit, right? Because there are exponentially many possible amplitudes contributing to that. But it turns out there's, you know, some very simple manipulation that you can do to fix that. So like, you know, the probability that you see one, well, this is the sum over x ending in one of norm beta x squared, right? So now we can write this out. All right. Sum over p ending in x, sum over p ending in, p prime ending in x. This one gets a star. All right, and then you can actually rewrite this as just one gigantic sum, so you don't have to do the sums individually. Like, you can write this as like the sum over x in, you know, any strings x that start with a one of the sum over, you know, two paths p and p prime, which both end in the same state x of alpha p, alpha p star. And furthermore, you know, you actually don't even need to take, you don't even need an imaginary counter. You can do it with a real counter because you know that this probability is going to be real. So that implies that in this sum, all the complex, you know, all the i's are going to cancel out, like, just because they have to by unitarity. So yeah, so it's actually, so this is the exponential sum you need to perform. You know, your sum got a little bit longer, in that you have to now have two path counters. But you know, besides that, this still is of the general form of an exponential sum of polytime computable terms. All right. So this is application one of quantum complexity physics. Anyone have any questions about this so far?
So it's proven mm-hmm. that it's a subset. Can you show that they're not equal as well?
So that's a great question. So the question was, can you show that BQP is a proper subset of p-space? And the answer is that unconditionally, we have almost no hope of doing this. And the reason is that the question of whether or not p equals p-space is essentially as difficult of a question of whether or not p equals np. In particular, we know a bunch of formal barriers that, like, certain types of proof will never resolve p versus np, like some sorts of proofs that you would think of kind of naturally. And all those barriers that we, you know, I think all those barriers actually apply to the p versus p-space problem. So this is something we're not really trying to do, is to prove that BQP is unconditionally smaller than p-space, but, you know, this is something we strongly believe, and, you know, if you assume certain conjectures, then you can get that, but we can't prove it unconditionally. So. All right. Cool. Yep?
Since you interpreted as path integral, integral, you can also do the stationary phase approximation to get a semi-classical trajectory. Does that have an interpretation?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. Yeah, because I'm not really familiar with the semi-classical trajectory sort of interpretation. Can you repeat the question again?
Since he interpreted as the path integral, then you can do the stationary phase approximation, take h bar go to zero to see what's the dominant path in a semi-classical limit.
I guess this expression doesn't have a h bar, so you cannot take
this is the unitary operator.
Right, but there's no h bar limit. It's just individual.
Yeah. This is already assuming quality. Yeah, there's no limit of taking the h bar to zero here or something like that. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Sorry.
Yep. Sure.
Can you make again the argument why you say that this tells us that those complexity classes are relevant for physics? Because I can follow your argument.
Sure. So the reason is that maybe by thinking about the relationship between quantum computers and these complexity classes, maybe I'll help you come up with better quantum simulation algorithms. Because now it's like this was something that I believe that complexity theorists figured out, that BQP's in p-space. So this is like some sort of application to quantum simulation. Yeah. I don't think people actually run the simulation though in practice. So I should caveat that bit because it still is a pretty long simulation time. But yeah.
So before this, they actually use the matrix way of exponential space.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no. So the thing is that, okay, it depends what questions you're trying to ask. This is just saying that if all you care about is if one particular bit is zero or one, then you can do this simulation method with less space. If you actually want to know like all the physics of the final state, like you want to know what's the probability that these three bits are zero or that this string is all these different values, then you do kind of have to have the whole state there to do that. Yeah. Cool. All right. So now I'm going to move on to application number two, which is in classifying the difficulty. Of problems that you encounter when trying to simulate quantum mechanics. This is kind of a similar thing to number one, but it'll be a completely different example. All right. So the example that I'm going to talk about here is about the complexity of tensor networks. So recall that a tensor network is just a very efficient way of representing certain types of quantum states. Right? So a tensor network is represented graphically by something like this. At each site, you imagine you have a matrix at each site with some indices. And the indices that are free, these are called like physical indices. The indices that are connected to other ones, these are called like let's call them like contracted indices. And the way that they represent the state is that if you label the physical indices like I1, I2, I3, et cetera, then the entry of the quantum state at index I1 up to IN, let's say each of the I1s is either 0 or 1, so this is a two-level system, it's just some gigantic sum of all of these matrices where their free index is set to I1, and then their contracted indices are summed over. So you have like some J summation indices. This is n, so you get like an n, you sum over that. This n also has an I2 index, but it also has another index here. I'm going to erase these so that I don't have to write as big of a matrix multiplication. And then this one is O, OJ3, I3, J4, et cetera, right? So this is a way of storing this exponentially large vector in a very compact representation, namely these small matrices. And the dimension of these matrices is just, is related to how big these indices you sum over are. And this is some quantity D. It's called the bond dimension. And that's normally assumed to be a constant. So maybe it's like 20 or 100 or something like that. But it's fixed as you scale the system size. All right, so in short, so the total amount that this representation of storage, this representation takes is like, you know, d to the maximum number of legs in a tensor times 2 or something like that, right? So it's some polynomial in the system size. All right. And now, as Guifre Verdal was talking about this morning, these tensor network states are oftentimes very useful for approximating the ground states of certain local Hamiltonians that arise in practice, right? So, for example, people often consider states which look like this, you know, just tensors on a line. This is called like a matrix product state. Sometimes they consider more complicated ones. These are like two-dimensional tensor networks where their physical indices go down. So this is called a PEPS. It's just a two-dimensional tensor network. And a nice, and as Guifre Verdal mentioned in his lecture, a lot of times you want to take your tensor network expression for a state and you want to extract some physical information from it, right? So for example, perhaps you might want to extract like the normalization of your state, like what's the inner product of psi with psi? Or what's the inner product of psi with some local operator, O, which say acts on only one or two of the qubits. These are sorts of natural things that you would want to do with your tensor network approximation of your state. And you know, there's like a pictorial representation of what this looks like. Is that, you know, if you have some tensor network like this, you know, with some legs going down, if you want to find the expectation value of some operator O acting at this site, all you do is you contract it with you know, the complex conjugate of your tensor network living down here. Right, so you connect this to this, this to this. This thing goes through the O, this thing doesn't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of like you're making an ice cream sandwich with your operator is kind of what you're doing. Okay, so a natural question is, what's the complexity of computing the value of a local observable? You know, this is like some expectation value of O you know, under the state. All right, and the problem with this is that if you write out this tensor network expression, like, you know, you could just write out what the value of this thing is. So what is this thing? This thing is like some sum over a whole bunch of indices of some, you know, matrix products, M, N, O, P, something like that, right? And now the number of indices that you're contracting, so is around two, sorry, is around N indices, right? If there are N different sites, and each of them takes, say, a value in zero or one. So this means this is an exponentially large sum. So the question is, what's the complexity of computing this sum? Is this like a p-space hard problem? Is this you know, is this problem NP hard? Is this problem in polynomial time? It's not necessarily obvious. So, you know, if you first look at this, you might start despairing or something, because you might think, okay, you know, there's an exponentially large sum, you know, this is probably going to be hopeless, right? You know, that's what the moral of the story is. But the weird thing is that in complexity, sometimes these exponentially large sums actually are efficiently computable for crafty reasons. Like, for example, we know that if you have an MPS state, then you actually can perform the exponentially large sum in polynomial time. And why is that? Well, the thing is that if you're performing a contraction with an MPS, then you know, there are a few different ways of writing out the sum. You know, one thing is you can write it up as this exponential sum. But the other thing that you can do is you can consider just contracting the indices one at a time. And there's some particular way of basically slowly closing the indices one at a time from left to right. If you do this, so let's say we just contract this tensor first. Now, if we do that, note that these two tensors contract to another tensor, right? So in other words, if you just contract this index, then what you get is something like this. And we have some operator O we're trying to apply eventually. So if we contract one index here, like in other words, instead of contracting all these indices at once, we're just going to contract this one at a time. And if you just contract these two indices, it's equivalent to just doing kind of matrix multiplication between the two tensors. So then this gives you a simplified tensor here. And then what you then do is you continue contracting your tensors one at a time. And it's kind of this algorithm where you do them from one side to the other. There's this kind of bubble of the stuff you've contracted so far that progresses from one side of the board to the other. And this is what allows you to do this in P. All right, so that's good. So that means that with certain types of tensor networks, you know, you can actually compute these expectation values efficiently. Now, there are other times in computational complexity where you can compute exponential sums for less trivial reasons. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, consider the determinant of a matrix. Well, the determinant, you know, has this abstract formula that says it's the sum over, if it's an n by n matrix, you can write it as the sum over permutations of the sign of the permutation times a I sigma of I. And if you look at this formula, you know, the number of permutations in SN is like n factorial. So this is an exponential sum. But we all know that you can compute the determinant efficiently in polynomial time. Why? Because you know that you can just, you know, diagonalize A and then just multiply its eigenvalues. And this is a polynomial time operation. Now, on the other hand, you know, other exponential sums of matrices are really hard. Like if you take something called the permanent, which is exactly the same quantity, where you just forget to put in this sign term, this is then actually a very hard problem. So the question is, where does this tensor general tensor network contraction fall? Is it on the easy side or is it on the hard side? Okay, all right. And the answer is that it lies very much on the hard side. So there is a theorem, which is due to, this is where I want to check my lecture notes. This is due to Such, Wolf, Verstrate, and Serac from 06, which says that in general, contracting tensor networks, even 2D tensor networks like PEPs, is something called sharp P hard. Furthermore, they also show the different result, which is the following. Suppose that you could that you could do the following. First, take a classical computer and write down some tensor network. Then imagine that you could have nature instantiate you that actual state. So this represents some state psi. Imagine that someone then hands you the psi that corresponds to, and then you then get to run a quantum computer. They showed that under this process, tensor networks have the same power as the class complexity class PP. All right, and these are both very difficult classes. So let me get some more chalk. All right, so what do I mean by sharp P hard? So as you saw in the lecture this morning, there's a one of the most famous problems in computer science is something called three satisfiability. And this is that the problem where you're given a collection of n Boolean variables, they're all either true or false, and you're given a collection of clauses, like I want x1 to be true, or I want x2 to be true, or I want x3 to be false. That's one clause. Yeah, and I want something else to be true, like I want x2 to be false, or I want x3 to be true, or I want x4 to be true, and et cetera. You're given the polynomial number of these. Then the problem is to determine, you know, does there exist a setting of the variables xi which satisfies all clauses. Now, even determining if one exists is a classic NP-hard problem. This is the Cook-Levin theorem. But a sharp P-hard problem is an even harder problem than that. So a sharp P-hard problem is count is the problem of counting the number of satisfying assignments. It's actually something called a sharp P complete problem, which is to say it's both in sharp P and it's the hardest type of problem that can exist in sharp P. So this is this. If you could solve this problem in polynomial time, then you could solve all of sharp P in polynomial time. And sharp P includes quantum computing and a huge amount of the complexity zoo. So this is really a gigantic class. So what does this result say? This result says that if you're trying to contract 2D tensor networks in your simulation, you know, you should give up all hope of trying to find some smart contraction algorithm, because one of these algorithms basically doesn't exist. So this is a statement that, you know, so if you're trying to perform things where, you know, you use PEPs and you compute expectation values of observables, you're going to have to do things like maybe try to approximate the values of these things or try to run some heuristics that don't work in all cases. Maybe they only work for very special setups, very special tensor inputs. But, you know, you actually aren't going to be able to write a very intelligent program that evaluates this exponential sum in a smart way, like the determinant. You're going to be stuck on doing it the hard way, like the permanent. Yep.
Does this mean that if you're, trying to use tensor networks in some misguided attempt to reproduce holography, that you're just doomed to fail?
Oh, so yeah. So the question was, what if you're using tensor networks to reproduce holography? The nice fact is that Mira tensor networks do not have this property. They are contractible in polynomial time. So this is one of the reasons why these Mira tensor networks that look like binary trees have proven popular, is that, you know, you actually can contract these efficiently in the computer science sense. Yeah.
But I guess this does mean that, like, this dodge that sometimes the tensor network people use, where they the holographic tensor network people use when they say, oh yeah, there are obvious problems with Mira, but we can just try another tensor network that may be somewhat disingenuous.
It's possible. I don't know if I'm going to ascribe to them like some moral statement, but all I'm saying is that generic tensor networks can be hard to contract, especially if you want to contract them exactly, and under some certain forms of approximation they could be hard too. So
why is it hard to contract a problem, or means that you don't have an
So yeah, so if a tensor network is hard to contract, you can't even check if your tensor network is normalized. So it seems, and this is something that you'd have to do in any calculation involving is divide by normalization of your state, right? So this means that you're going to have to. This isn't saying that tensor networks are doomed. Like, people use tensor networks a lot in practice. They use these 2D PEPs all the time. It's just saying that they use very special types of them, because if you specifically engineer certain PEPs, you can use contraction to solve very hard problems. So, yeah. So this is not a statement about average case complexity. It's a statement about worst case complexity. Yeah.
Your argument that this is physically relevant, that you're showing this, because what they consider is something they can compute, right? They consider specific instances, not the worst case.
Yeah, that's correct. So they do consider specific instances, but what it's kind of telling people is that when you're writing your simulations, you need to have in your mind that you're going to be using very particular types of tensor networks, and you're going to have to be using special properties about those. So it's not necessarily you can't do it. It's just saying that you have to keep this in mind when you're doing this. Like, you can't just naively do something. Like, you have to Like, if you're making an approximation, you know, they might make an approximation that has a physical intuition as to why it's true. But, you know, that's kind of a physics question, less of a TCS question. Yeah, yeah, and that's a fair question, though. Yeah. All right, cool. All right, with my remaining time, I'm going to cover the last reason you should care about it, which is that it actually sometimes helps you reason about the complexity of real-world things. So what do I mean by that? So in general, when you think about complexity theory, the natural classes you think about are those that are physically realizable. But the strange thing is that sometimes, in order to reason about physically realizable classes, you actually have to think about very non-physical classes in the interim. I'll give you an example about this. And the complexity problem that I'm going to talk about is the problem of quantum sampling. So you may have heard about this. So the basic setup is this. Imagine that you have a quantum computer. You have a system of n qubits. And then you perform polynomially made two-qubit gates, the usual setup. And now imagine that at the end, you actually measure all the different qubits at once. So what this does is this creates some probability distribution, d, which is over strings of length n. A natural question is, how hard is it for a classical computer to simulate this distribution? Well, we know that if you could simulate this distribution, it could factor. You know, because if you could simulate the distribution, you could just simulate the whole quantum circuit, right? So we know that this is not going to be super easy, but you know, so all right, so we know it's as hard as factoring. But you know, factoring is not actually an NP hard problem or something like that. So actually, we expect that factoring is not NP hard. So as a result, you know, the evidence that factoring is hard is not really as strong as the evidence that 3-sat or counting the number of satisfying assignments is hard. Like, if tomorrow someone came up with a polynomial time classical factoring algorithm, it wouldn't really break anything in complexity other than making quantum computing theorists very sad. So, you know, we might like to ask, you know, is there like a different basis that we can base our belief in like quantum supremacy over classical computers on? And the answer is there is, with this complexity, I mean, with the sampling paradigm. And there's this nice theorem, which is due to Aronson and Arkhipov in 2011, and this is Bremner, Joza, and Shepard. I think it was also 11. And what they showed is that if a classical computer as in a randomized algorithm can exactly simulate these distributions, then something called the polynomial hierarchy collapses to the second level. Oh, actually, wait, they showed it for the third. Though there's actually a later theorem that says that it goes to the second level as well. All right, so what is this polynomial hierarchy? This sounds like some abstract complexity statement, but I'm going to try to convince you that the polynomial hierarchy is a really natural generalization of the P versus NP question. So I'm going to describe the polynomial hierarchy to you inductively. So the polynomial hierarchy is something like this. The zeroth level is the class P, just those things you can do in polynomial time. The first level is the following. It's those languages which are accepted for which x is in the language, if and only if something like this is true. If there exists some proof y, which is also, say, an n-bit string, or polynomial length string, such that a of x, y is 1. And here, a is a p algorithm. It's an algorithm from one level down in the hierarchy. And the other thing that lives in this level is the same thing with a for all quantifier. Okay, and now what are these two classes? Well, this is just saying that there exists a proof which causes you to accept, right? So this is actually just another very fancy way of stating the class NP. And now this statement that, you know, for all y, this is true, you know, you can rewrite this as not there exists a of x equals 0, right? A of x, y equals 0, right? And the reason you can rewrite that is that in general saying that, you know, for all qubits, some statement phi is true, this is saying, you know, all these are true, that's saying not all of them are false, right? So this is saying that not all of them are false, right? It's just like a general logic step. So what this is this class is the complement of NP. It's called co-NP, and what it is, it's all those problems for which you can prove the answer is no. All right, so NP is like those problems for which you can prove the answer is yes, and co-NP is those problems for which you can prove the answer is no. So for instance, now these classes might be different. So I'll give you an example. So satisfiability is an NP, because if you want to prove to someone that a formula is satisfiable, you just give them a satisfying assignment. But how would you prove to someone that a formula is not satisfiable? I mean, you know, one way would be to iterate over all the assignments and show them it's false on every one, but you know, that's an exponentially long proof. You know, it's really not clear that there would be a concise proof of this fact that something's unsatisfiable. And you could maybe hope that you could do some fancy manipulation with these three set formulas to derive a contradiction, but in general, that actually seems very difficult. So the conjecture is actually that not only is P not equal to NP, but co-NP is not equal to NP either. So, all right, so that's the first level. And the second level of the polynomial hierarchy is defined analogously, but you just take it one level more abstract. So you say that something's in the second level if there exists some proof string y, such that for all proof string z, a of x, y, z is 1. Or the same thing with a different alternating quantifier. And these are complements of one another as well. So what are these classes? These are kind of like, you just take NP, you just abstract at one level. So instead of asking like, oh, these are statements we can prove efficiently, these are statements that we can prove, you can't prove them efficiently, right? So, and the third level is just defined similarly. There are statements you can prove that you can prove them efficiently, and et cetera. So it gets a bit, you know, to define the kth level, all you do is you consider k quantifier alternations. Okay? And now it's known that if any level of the hierarchy is equal to any other level, then the entire thing is just equal to that level. So all right. So pH is formally equal to the union over finite numbers, you know, natural numbers k, of the kth level of the polynomial hierarchy. And there's a theorem that if the kth level is equal to the k plus first, then that actually implies all of pH is equal to the kth level. And if that occurs, this is called the collapse of the polynomial hierarchy to the second level. Now, what you should think of this of is, so this non-collapse of pH is a standard assumption complexity theory. And what's the reason for that? Well, if pH were to collapse, it would be kind of a ridiculous thing, because what we'd be saying is that, okay, so you know, why do we believe P is not equal to NP? Well, we think it's really hard to remove this quantifier, right? But now if pH collapses to some level, it would say that you can, you know, there's a magic number of 7, like where if you have 7 quantifiers, 7 alternations between quantifiers, you can express, you know, 100 million alternations between quantifiers efficiently, right? So this is, you know, this would be kind of a very strange world to live in if that were true. Because it, you know, so if you believe, yeah, so it's essentially, if P equals NP, then the hierarchy collapses to the zeroth level. If co-NP equals NP, it collapses to the first level. And you know, these, assuming it doesn't collapse to the second or the third, these are just kind of generalizations of that statement. All right. And now, how do you prove that this sort of polynomial hierarchy collapses if you can simulate circuits? That's actually a very interesting problem. Because that problem, like the proof of that, looks something like this. So the proof of that is something like this. Like, suppose, so I'll prove the theorem. So suppose that a classical computer could simulate these distributions. Let's say it could simulate them exactly. Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to take this question about a physically realizable model computation, and we're going to boost it up to a question about gigantic complexity classes that don't really seem relevant for the real world. So we're going to consider some classes like post-BPP. This is like problems you can solve with a randomized algorithm where you have the magical power to pre-specify some outcome. Or let's say the magical power to restrict to some outcomes. Like for instance, imagine that you drew distribution samples from your distribution D, and you got something like this. Or you drew another sample, you got something like this. And you say, actually, I only want to see those samples where the first half of the bits are 1, 0. So I'm just going to imagine that if this happened on my machine, I just get to cross out this occurrence. That's what post-selection is. It's kind of like you run your experiment, and then at the end in your analysis, you just condition on some certain subset of your experimental outcomes. Now, the reason I say this is unrealistic is that, in general, these outcomes could be exponentially unlikely. So this isn't something you could actually do in the lab, because if you had a large experiment and you ran it many times, you'd get extremely few samples that satisfied this property, or maybe even none at all. So it would be almost impossible to collect statistics on what goes on in this small set of outcomes. Yeah.
Can you just restrict it to everything?
Oh, yeah, so there's some, there's a restriction that the thing that you restrict on has to be polynomial time computable or something like this. So that's that, yeah, that keeps you from like tautologically putting in the answers to hard things. Yeah. Okay, cool. All right. And you know, you can define an analogous class for quantum computing, which is the same for quantum computers. And there's this crazy fact that if these things are equal, then that implies the polynomial hierarchy collapses to the third level. All right, and the reason is that basically this complexity class is actually turns out to be, like the quantum version of it turns out to be way more powerful than the classical version of it. It's this discrepancy that leads to this. Because, you know, if you, and you can immediately see this implies a theorem, because if you imagine you had a simulator of this distribution, then that would mean that you could just post-select your simulator, and that would have the same behavior as post-selecting your quantum computer, right? Because we're assuming it's a perfect simulation. So that would mean that these classes are equal, and that's what implies the collapse. So, and if you actually want to understand why this is true, it's actually a really complicated foray into complexity theory. Like, the reason this is true is that, let's see here, pH is in the class P to the sharp P is in the class I, this is equal to P to the post BQP. And now if we claim that that's equal to P to the post BPP, bear with me, then that implies that this is actually contained in the third level of the polynomial hierarchy, where this follows by the Sipser-Gox theorem. This follows by Todas theorem. This follows by Aaronson's result that post BQP is equal to PP. And this is your assumption. So, all right, so you had to go through this gigantic, so in order to prove this result about these real world circuits, you had to take a gigantic detour through like some very abstract complexity theory that involves, you know, these classes, which are not, this is like, you imagine you have the ability to solve these hard chart P problems instantly, then what could you solve? There's some very cool result that actually contains the whole polynomial hierarchy. Like if you can count things well, you can solve any level of the hierarchy. And this is comes from some classification of the power of post-selected quantum circuits. And this comes from some theorem that's trying to show that BPP is not much bigger than P. So in short, you know, I think this is a remarkable thing because, you know, it's showing that, you know, this often happens a lot in math, where you have a concrete problem, and you think, you know, I know that mathematicians have thought of more abstract versions of this problem, but, you know, you usually, you know, sometimes you might think, you know, maybe this doesn't help me that much. You know, like, how could abstracting the problem make it easier? But it turns out, I mean, this is kind of the magic of mathematics, that a lot of times that actually helps you to solve your concrete problem, because, you know, having explored more general properties of the things that you're studying, it gives you insight into the more specific object you're studying. So this is kind of an example of that sort of relationship. So yeah, so in order to prove that quantum computers can sample exactly from some distributions that are hard, you know, it actually requires a decent understanding of complexity. So yeah, so I think this is the third reason physicists should care about complexity for reasoning about systems that and experiments that they can actually perform. So, all right, with that, I'll take any questions. Thanks. Yeah.
I have a question about this exactly. Because when we talk about exactly simulating a probability distribution with many outcomes, I guess.
Yes.
Then
that's right. That's right.
Doesn't make so much sense physically.
Exactly. So yeah. So the question asked was, how much does it make sense to consider exact simulation? And the answer is, it's not a very realistic error assumption at all. So you know, you can extend it a little bit to the point where you allow multiplicative error on every individual output. Like saying each output is within like a multiplicative root 2 of the actual probability, right? But this is still not a realistic error model because that's actually, you know, fault tolerance or something like that wouldn't give you that promise, right? So that, because, you know, in fault tolerance, you know, it could be that one of these computational paths like just gets destroyed and your circuit never outputs it. And then that then destroys this approximation guarantee. So in their original work, and some follow-up work. So Aaronson and Arkhipov and Bremner, Shepard, and Montanaro showed that you can get hardness of sampling results if you assume a more realistic error bound, which is that, you know, it's hard to sample from these distributions within constant L1 distance. So this is in like total variation distance. So this is a more realistic error model. But they could only do that by introducing some additional conjectures that are not yet proven. So at the moment, we don't know how to remove those conjectures to get a statement that the noisy simulation is hard for a polynomial hierarchy. We only know how to do that with other assumptions now. But that's definitely kind of a hot topic that people are looking into in quantum complexity.
It's kind of hard to argue that this is physically relevant.
Yeah, that's okay. It's possibly true that makes these results less physically relevant, but I think it depends on what you're trying to get out of the results. So if you're, so let's imagine that, so Aronson and Arkhipov actually showed that this is true for non-interacting boson, for systems of non-interacting bosons, that you can use them to sample from distributions which have these properties. And maybe you could hope that, you know, you might be able to perform this experiment with small enough errors that you could do this experiment for like 20 or 30 bosons, at which point it would already be pretty hard to compute with your laptop because a 2 to the 30 by 2 to the 30 matrix is pretty big. So yeah, so although it's true that if you want to get true asymptotic speedups, you really need a fault-tolerant version of this theorem, you know, I think its main practical use is in, you know, maybe we could create some small experiments where we're accurate enough that we don't need to go to fault tolerance, and, you know, maybe we could then use that to challenge the extended Church-Turing thesis. I think that's primarily the way people think about these, because if you go asymptotics, you'd have to put error correction in all these things. Yeah, it's a good point. All right. Any other questions?
What's delta 3
then? Oh, delta 3 is the third level of pH. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.